Hi, this is RJ McGill, host of the Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin 104.1 FM. In the next hour, we're bringing you some of the year's best interviews from the Berlin Journal archive. First up, Professor of Film and Media Studies Edward Dimmenberg. Dimmenberg's latest book focuses on film noir and Hollywood in the 1940s and 50s. He spoke with Spiegel Online editor Daryl Lindsay earlier this year about the German connection to Hollywood. And later in the hour, a documentary on the Haus des Rundfunks.
So you were born and raised in Manhattan. What drew you to Los Angeles to study film?
Well, I went to graduate school at the University of California in Santa Cruz in the mid-1980s, and the academic job market was very bad at that time, and I began to work for the University of California Press, and I was hired as their humanities editor in the UCLA office in 1990, and I moved from the San Francisco Bay Area, from Berkeley, in fact, to Los Angeles in that year. And when I arrived in Los Angeles, I felt as if I had landed on the moon. I had never really driven my car very much. I wasn't used to the great distances. I constantly got lost. I had no sense of how one made friends in a place that was so spread out. And it really took a couple of years until I began to feel comfortable there. But today I would live nowhere else.
Your most recently published book was on film noir in Los Angeles in the 1940s and 1950s. Now you're looking at films from 1970s to the present. How significantly has the city changed in that time?
Since the 1940s and 50s, the urban fabric of Los Angeles has changed radically. Los Angeles has never had a good record in the area of historical preservation, and many of its most significant architectural landmarks, many of the great examples of Art Deco architecture, many of the neighborhoods in which the film noir cycle of the 1940s and 1950s was made. Many of those neighborhoods have been eradicated, destroyed by urban renewal programs. The city continues to become more decentralized. It spreads out. It's become even more suburbanized than it was at the time. And in some sense, to search after the film noir of the 1940s and 1950s is to search after a city that no longer exists. And for this reason, I think filmmakers have become fascinated by its traces, by its remains. And the film I think of here is a film made by the Los Angeles filmmaker Pat O'Neill called The Decay of Fiction that takes place in the old Ambassador Hotel, which throughout the 1920s was the most important gathering spot for Hollywood movie stars in the city. It was the regular location for the Oscar ceremonies throughout the 1930s. And about 3 years ago, it was destroyed, torn down to construct a public school in that part of the city. And just before it was destroyed, for about 10 years prior to that, O'Neill began to film in the city. And his film was really an attempt to capture some of these ghosts, so to speak. And one literally sees ghosts in the movies. It's quite brilliantly made and involves an elaborate use of digital technology in which actual locations and contemporary actors dressed like film noir characters of the 1940s and 1950s float past each other. And this is a film that I think most effectively utilizes the legacy of film noir and suggests how it can make us aware of the past of the city.
Los Angeles is a city that's entirely associated with the filmmaking industry. That's its image in the world. What has had more influence, the city of Los Angeles on film or film on the city of Los Angeles?
I think it's always some combination of both. But only recently have architects and urban planners referred explicitly to the tradition of film as a resource. And the example I'm thinking of here is a building that was recently constructed in the downtown of the city near the Staples Athletic and Cultural Center. And it took the film Blade Runner as its model and has a screen on the exterior facade on which advertisements are projected. And this is very clearly an example of a classic postmodern film inspiring contemporary architecture and urbanism. And it's one of the few examples I can think of, because usually it works the other way around. Filmmakers simply utilize the environment that they find all around them. And it's much more rare to find the environment actually responding to film and incorporating its visual cues.
In the films that you're studying right now, which do you think are the most seminal for people who want to understand the developments that have happened in Los Angeles to really understand what the city has become today?
I think there's a film called Chavez Ravine that I would recommend without hesitation, about the destruction of a Chicano neighborhood in downtown Los Angeles, today the home of the Dodgers baseball stadium. And it's an interesting film because it involves interviews with people who actually lived in this neighborhood throughout the 1940s and 1950s. And today, of course, in the age of sustainability and eco-architecture, everyone wants a garden. The current fad in Los Angeles among yuppies is to raise chickens and to raise farm animals. And of course, this is what these people were already doing in the 1930s, 1940s, and 1950s. And they had plenty of green space for their children. And their neighborhood was a five-minute walk to the center of the city. So in some ways, it seemed like a paradise. But for reasons of racism, it was later destroyed. And this film and the accompanying book provide a very useful example to the suggestion that the city has lacked forms of life that were viable, and that the previous urban forms were all slums or all neighborhoods where criminals lived and where criminality bred. And this, of course, was the suggestion that the mayor and the Los Angeles Times advanced throughout the 1940s and 1950s as a pretense for the urban renewal projects that took place starting at the end of the 1940s. These were neighborhoods that were slums. These were neighborhoods that housed criminals. These were neighborhoods that were dangerous and needed to be destroyed. And a film like Chavez Ravine gives the lie to that. Another significant film was made in 1972 for the British Broadcasting Company, the BBC, called Rainer Banham Loves Los Angeles. And to me, this is a film that is significant for its suggestion that we need to encounter Los Angeles in motion through the windshield of a moving automobile. And in some sense, the freeway constitutes the closest the city ever has to an effective public space. Banham recognized that there was a problem about public and private space in Los Angeles, that the best architecture was not always accessible to the public, and that the freeways were an important exception to this, that the freeways offered stunning visual experiences that allowed one to travel at relatively fast speeds of 60 or 70 miles an hour through clover leaves and cover great distances. Of course, the great irony is that when one goes and looks at Banham's films today, it becomes clear that the freeways no longer allow people to travel this quickly, and they're usually full with traffic jams. So in some sense, film represents perhaps the most effective way of obtaining a sense of what the city actually looked like in the 1940s and 1950s, to get a sense of how the city actually appeared before it was redeveloped and increasingly suburbanized and increasingly turned into the type of global mecca of consumerism that all cities today have become.
For listeners just joining the program, this is Berlin Journal. I'm Daryl Lindsay in conversation with Professor Edward Dimmenberg of University of California, Irvine. Today we're talking about Los Angeles and its depictions in film. You've also written that ailments in the city, like traffic, like crime, might eventually serve as themes for the movies being made in Los Angeles. Have you seen that trend happening yet?
The most interesting example of an ailment serving as an inspiration for a film about Los Angeles is a film made by the filmmaker and film professor Tom Anderson called Los Angeles Plays Itself. And this film is in fact a compilation of other films about Los Angeles, some Hollywood films, some films by European filmmakers, many low-budget films, many student films. It's a long film. It's about 3 hours long. And I sometimes joke with Anderson that he filmed some of these movies in his own basement. So obscure they have never been able to find many of them, even in the best video stores. But what he does is to systematically explore the myths, the obsessions that Hollywood film has about Los Angeles. And it's possible to watch his film and note a real tone of anger in his voice. Anderson is tired of the city being presented as a case study in urban pathology. And he's lived in Los Angeles all his life and is attempting to search for a different way of representing the city, for which reason he becomes very interested in the films of contemporary African-American filmmakers such as Charles Burnett, whose Killer of Sheep is an important point of reference for him, and Billy Woodbury, whose film Bless Their Little Hearts is also an important point of reference for him.
It's ironic you've come to Berlin to study Los Angeles film. These are two cities that have very deep historical ties. There was the wave of emigres, actually several waves of emigres, that left Germany to go to Los Angeles, where they had a very deep impact on the film industry. And today, many Hollywood films are produced here in Berlin. As you're doing your work, do you think about these historical connections?
Of course, I think about them all the time. And it has long been clear to me that the American cinema would not be what it is today without the contribution of the many German film émigrés, from the great director Murnau in the 1920s to figures such as Fritz Lang and Billy Wilder and Fred Zinnemann and Robert Siodmak, many of whom, of course, made the great film noir films of the 1940s and 1950s. I think Germans have always had a love-hate relationship to Southern California. Many of the most illustrious exiles, such as Brecht, hated it and never felt themselves at home, and thought that it represented everything most superficial, most dangerous, most banal about mass culture. Others, such as Lang or Douglas Sirk, found themselves very much at home and were able to realize some of their best work in the Hollywood studio system. So I think it's a mixed bag. Today, of course, we see filmmakers such as Werner Herzog living in Los Angeles. Other figures as well have moved there. So there continues to be a great deal of traffic back and forth between the two cities. And I think they both qualify as what I would call film metropoles. They both qualify as centers of film production. And Germans continue to be fascinated by the sunshine, by the speed, by the highways, by the mobility, by the legacy of Hollywood. And I've long noticed that this seems to have a particular attraction for them, perhaps for no German filmmaker more than Wim Wenders, who made what for me remains his most effective film, The State of Things, in 1982 in Los Angeles, and explored some of these themes in it.
Professor Dimmenberg, thank you very much for joining us today on NPR Radio.
It was my pleasure.
I'm Daryl Lindsay from Spiegel Online, sitting with Edward Dimmenberg, Associate Professor of Film and Media Studies at the University of California, Irvine. You're listening to Berlin Journal on NPR.
Next up, we talk to Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc about her book Random Family and Rough Living in the Bronx. LeBlanc spent the spring at the American Academy constructing a book about comedians in New York City based on 6 years' worth of notebooks. Stand-up comics, she says, not only provided her laughs and psychological insight, but it forced her to think about her own performance as a journalist. LeBlanc spent over a decade with an extended Bronx family for her critically acclaimed book Random Family, published in 2002. A finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, the work was named one of the year's 10 best by the New York Times Book Review. And in September 2006, LeBlanc received a MacArthur Genius Grant. Some critics said Random Family single-handedly revived American long-form journalism. In reporting for Random Family, LeBlanc entered the murky world of drug dealers, prison culture, crippling poverty, and the lives of two young women, Coco and Jessica. It all started when she approached a man nicknamed Boy George, a big-time heroin dealer in the mid-1990s.
Boy George, who's one of the main characters in the book, actually, there was a short piece about him in, I think it was Newsday, about his upcoming trial, so I just went to check it out. A friend called me and said, oh, you should check this out, this really young kid, he's on trial under this new law, the Kingpin Law, which was an attempt to prosecute higher-up drug dealers instead of the lower-level folks, so I just went to the courtroom to see what was going on.
And what were some of the details about his lifestyle that were fascinating?
Well, part of the reason he was even in Newsday was that he was one of the youngest, most successful heroin dealers. He was making millions of dollars. You know, at his height, I think he was making over $500,000 a week. He had over 30 employees. He'd figured out that heroin was a good bet during the heyday of crack. He was, unlike many young dealers, he was actually trying to invest the money into legitimate businesses. So he had a sort of scale of ambition that far exceeded, you know, most kids that were dealing drugs. And certainly, you know, his obvious entrepreneurial skills were striking. And he had this crazy, lavish lifestyle, you know, Porsches and parties and gold, all that.
And did you approach him in the courtroom?
I did. I went, introduced myself. I had an assignment with Rolling Stone at the time just to do a straight profile of him and asked if he was interested, and he was. And then I just began to just show up. And it was through that time in the courtroom I met his girlfriend Jessica, and Jessica introduced me to Coco, and Coco introduced me to Caesar, and it all went from there, but it began as a very straight-up story.
How did they accept you?
Boy George had an incredible ego, as you can imagine, and I think he felt at the time that perhaps the story would help him. In some way, it would redeem him. It was not, he was not admitting that he was dealing drugs. His defense during the trial was that he was a jewelry dealer, and we made an arrangement that if he was not convicted, then I wasn't going to be able to publish the story. But if he was convicted and then lost on his appeal, then all the information that he'd given me directly about his illegal business I could use, which of course took years. But the girls were much more welcoming. I mean, I think they were vaguely curious about me. It was fun to have someone around who was following them around from a newspaper. But pretty quickly, they would not forget about me. I just wasn't that central. They were young teenage girls living their lives, you know. I don't really think I meant that much, in a way. I was a nice person that was around.
Did that change over the years? I mean, you were with them for a decade, right?
Yeah.
Did that change into a friendship?
It did. A friendship in my book, but a complicated friendship for sure, because it's not, or maybe friendship isn't the word at the, it's hard to say that I think friendship involves an element of reciprocity, and there certainly was a lot going on between us. We were both giving things and taking things from one another, but it wasn't, I guess, a conventional friendship in that regard. And the tricky part for me was how to preserve their freedom to reject me over time as we became more close. You know, because when you've been going to someone's house for 5 years, it's harder for them to say, could you excuse us? We would like you to leave now. But, you know, even though I was there as a journalist and a family friend by that point, it's much easier if a journalist is there for a week for someone to say, do you mind stepping out? Or actually, we don't want you to come with us to the courthouse or whatever. So, but I think I probably was more worried about that than they were. I can't even say the main principal characters were frustrated with me overtly much. It was more peripheral people that were suspicious sometimes or uncomfortable if I was there, and I would always defer to that discomfort and leave. I mean, I felt uncomfortable if neighbors came over and they were uncomfortable that I was there. I would find an excuse to go outside or take a walk or whatever.
That very issue of discomfort that comes up brings up the sort of larger point about these moral issues that have been written about before, and we've talked about earlier project like AG's and Evans' Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, being in Hale County, Alabama. In Road to Wagon Pier by Orwell, there's always the observer and the observed, and you have sort of class differences and race differences, obviously, and it's been written about a lot. Is this something that became heightened in any way? Was it something that was always in your mind, the sort of white privilege versus other classes, other races, etc., that's sort of integral to documentary?
After the book was done, I certainly began to have sort of full assault of that consciousness, both because people were demanding me to think about it and because all of a sudden it became this object in the world where these people that I know became characters and my experience became a project and all that. Of course it was also those things. I'm not saying I wasn't aware of them, but I don't think of it that way. But I guess for me, the moral questions aren't journalistic. They are more like, well, I'm writing about poverty that's been around for God knows how long. Isn't that the problem? Or when people would say, well, you know, didn't you do anything about, you know, she didn't have food, didn't you do something? Or when she went to hit the baby, didn't you do something? And I think, you know, how could you sort of do that? And I said, well, how can you, I mean, I gave 12 years of my life to documenting this. What, I mean, maybe I should have brought a pack of Pampers or something, but what are you doing? You know, what are you, why is this the location of that anger or that frustration? I understand it. There is a connection, but it to me is very much about the inability for us to stomach the implication of what it means that this exists and that it's painful and it's uncomfortable. And
when the book came out, these things became objectified and abstracted, right. and there they are. Why do you think that the focus then lands on these issues that maybe you have not thought about?
Mm-hmm. I think it depends on the readership, because very different events that I attended or readings that I gave or reading groups that read the book responded very differently. So there was a fairly consistent, I'm generalizing, academic response to the book, which almost inevitably led to the question of race privilege. Like, I never had that question anywhere but in an academic environment. That was like the first question, and that went on. And I did get to the point where I would stop talking about it, because I said, I can actually role play all the questions that will come and I'll answer, and I'll happily talk to you about this after the lecture, but I'm just not going through that drill anymore. Not because I don't think it's important, but in fact, it has nothing, I mean, I can't bring anything new to it. And I sort of feel, look, I would rather talk about what the book brings up, and I will happily talk to journalists about that experience, but it's not where I'm most uncomfortable, in the sense of it's not being a white person in a Hispanic neighborhood. That sort of isn't the way I experience my time there, you know?
Yeah.
But in other audiences, you know, audiences, say, in communities that were more akin to the people that I wrote about in the book, there was much more, interestingly, much more questioning around what could be done about the problems, you know, in the sense that people came forward with their stories and said that they, too, had these experiences, and in the feeling of seeing them systemically, what could be done. And I thought that was an interesting, you know.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin. We're speaking with journalist Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc.
I want to jump into sort of what you're working on mm-hmm. now. So you spent some time at the Academy, and the project that you're working on is about comedians in New York City.
Yes, it's stand-up comedians.
It's a jump, but where are things now, and how did that come about?
Well, the stand-up comics came out of, quite directly from my interest in trying to talk about the sexual abuse of boys. That there was some of the characters in the book that had been sexually abused, but I wasn't able to really get into that in the book. And there was a comic who just so happened to address this issue in his act. Somebody told me about it. It's how a lot of my stories start. My friends will always say, hey, Adrian, I know you're interested. I always let everyone know what I'm interested in. And if you ever hear of something, let me know. So people say, oh, there's this guy. He's talking about sexual abuse. He's a guy. I went to see him, and I got interested, and he was a stand-up comedian, and then I began to follow him around for an assignment, and then it very quickly became a book. I think also it's very much a book about a man's world, and I think Random Family, for the most part, while men are extremely important, clearly, it was quite a bit of a woman's world. Mm-hmm. You know, I think of the book as a time in my life in a world of women, and certainly this last 6-year stretch has been the men's zone, I think.
And how long have you been working on the comics?
I started reporting it, I think, at the end of 2002, and this book came out in 2003. I was just finishing the copy editing and the final edits of Random Family, and I've been writing this book, I guess, for the past maybe 6 months, so 6 years, 7 years, oh God, 7 years.
You feel more active in this?
Much more active.
In this role?
Yeah, and it feels like a role. I mean, that's the other interesting thing, is I think I've labored under the illusion, or needed to labor under the illusion, that I, in fact, was just being myself out there in the world. And this book has really made me think hard about whether or not that's true, because I feel as though it is a role, and that's a very uncomfortable thing for me.
Has their performativeness made you more aware of your own, or do you feel like you've had to compete with them in a sense, because comedians...
I'm smart enough to know I can't compete, and but I feel very interested in the dynamic between authenticity and performance. So, for example, when I, like, you know, we say we, you and I have this conversation, and you talk to me about this thing you're thinking, and then you know, 3 days later, you're on stage, and it's a bit, right? It's a joke, and you've been working it over. I remember the first few times I felt a little betrayed. I thought we were having a real conversation, and there you are working your bit. And then I realized, well, that's what comics do, actually. That is how they work their bit. And why does that feel a little disheartening to me? And then it made me think, well, is this connected to what it feels like to talk to a journalist, which is you and I can have this really great conversation, but then I go home and I actually write an article about it. And how does... So I'm very interested in trying to have the book both certainly tell a narrative story about stand-up comedy and implicitly be a meditation on the role of the journalist as a performer, maybe, or as a thinking observer. Ideally, I'd say a double profile, but it might be too ambitious.
Has there been anything, I mean, you're writing about comics, has there been anything actually funny?
A lot? Happened? Yeah, I've laughed a lot. No, it's less funny than one would imagine unless you know comedy or comics, then you would not imagine a lot of fun. But, you know, a lot of laughs. And I have become a much more irreverent person, and I think quite a bit more aggressive in teasing. And I mean, the comics often refer to the civilian world. I sort of think, you know, I've got to sort of rein it in a little bit because you just are used to people commenting on anything freely and that you're supposed to take it, and you actually do take it because you don't take it so personally.
Did your experience that you're having now, so you feel a little more, you feel a little looser, etc., what's the difference between what this project is doing and what your first project did?
Well, I think that project made me, my sense of my own voice and my own opinion recede in a way, both out of respect for being taught about this world from the people that were allowing me to write about them. It was a profound humility that I really had nothing to throw into the pot, if you know what I mean, because I was watching people who had survived adversity for a hell of a long time, and on top of just managing that were allowing me to figure it out and show me what was going on. So there wasn't a lot of, like, my voice or my opinion or my presence was, it was a subordinate one in a way. And in the comedy world, while I don't exist as me, Adrian, in a specific sense, I exist in the role of an audience. So I'm always called upon to listen and respond. And that has stirred up the desire, actually, to speak and have an opinion and say something. And that's interesting because I was quite proud of myself for having, you know, this lack of a need to insert myself into people's business. I don't feel like I want to give you an opinion on your life, but I feel quite hungry to chime in.
So thanks for joining us on the Berlin Journal, and we'll hope to see you back in Berlin, Adrian.
Thank you.
After the break, the historic Haus des Rundfunks. This is NPR Berlin.
1 minute after 5 in the morning.
The president of the World Bank is calling.
1 minute after noon.
New York City authorities are investigating a second deadly crane collapse.
1 minute after 5 in the evening.
The commander of the Joint African Union has said.
1 minute after 11 at night.
At least one tornado is reported to have touched down today.
What's happening? What's known? What's next? 1 minute after the hour, every hour, every day. From NPR News.
This is R.J. McGill. Today, the Haus des Rundfunks is an international center for broadcasting and training, most notably for its radio documentaries. But, like Berlin itself, the Haus des Rundfunks has seen its share of tragedy and hardships in its 80-year history. For almost 3 decades, it was under state control in the GDR. Goethe Institute producer Alex van Ost discusses the history of the Haus des Rundfunks with two of its radio producers.
There is a famous short story by Nobel Prize-winning writer Heinrich Böll about a radio producer who is slightly losing his grip. He collects bits of tape recordings with nothing but silence on them, splices the little pieces together, and then listens to them with his girlfriend, to the recordings of silence. In his office building, there is an old elevator with no doors, just compartments, one after another, going up and down. And this producer likes to step in, ride up, And then, when he reaches heaven, he rides down again, over and over. It's relaxing. The producer in this story does not exist. He is fiction. But the endless elevator is not fiction. It does exist. It's in the old Berlin Broadcast House, the Haus des Rundfunks, which has seen many things since 1931. And none of those things is fiction either. To understand the Haus des Rundfunks, better to start here, in Potsdamer Platz, the Times Square of Berlin. 20 years ago, there was nothing here, just the Berlin Wall, rubble, and a death zone, a no-man's land. But before that, in the 1920s, this was a hub, Europe's busiest intersection, with the first electric traffic lights on the continent. And on the top floor of a building here, the Vauxhaus, Germany's first radio studios. But it was too noisy, so radio, the hot new medium of the time, moved across town, west to the Reichskanzlerplatz, later called Adolf Hitlerplatz, and today Theodor Heuss Platz. There they built a temple for radio, a remarkable building with a strange shape, and made of bricks the color of earth, of cooked cabbage, of pumpernickel, of Weimaraner dogs, of liver, of Berlin. The new broadcast house, the Haus des Rundfunks. There was traffic here too, so they built it to be very quiet.
So, we are now here in the huge entrance hall of Haus des Rundfunks, called Lichthof. Lichthof means Hall of Light.
Radio producer Peter Leonard Braun has worked in this broadcast house for nearly half a century.
The complete roof of the building is one enormous stretch out of glass, so you get a lot of natural light into it. It was at this time the biggest and the most technical and the most perfect solution of a radio building, because, for example, the outer walls are always double, and each wall is separate, is not linked to the other one. The outside is like a huge form of a ship, and inside that huge form of a ship, you have big studio complexes, absolutely surrounded by offices, by corridors. It was protected, it was an inside leaf construction, never having been done before.
The office doors are closed, the halls seem strangely empty, the studios tucked away. But emptiness is an illusion here, for the Haus des Rundfunks is a kind of wonder box of the imagination that has poured out drama, features, music. The Germans used to call it Sing Sing.
What's happening?
I think they are for a concert, practicing.
Archivist Christian Collette.
We have to go around to the other side of the building. The building is not orthogonal, it's half round. And at the next door you can go in different ways. It's a labyrinth. You can go there, there, or there. And where's the exit?
Where is the exit?
This way.
Colette lives in a world of tape recordings, now being put onto computer. But the tapes are kept, just in case.
Right. This tape, we must conserve it, because we don't know what digital material has a quality in 30 years. And these tapes last 50 years, 60 years.
A few miles away from the Haus des Rundfunks, 30 or so guests gather at the home of Wolfgang Bauernfeind for wine and snacks. And then they stop talking and sit down to listen.
der Globalisierung. Wir haben jetzt heute Abend ein Stück, das sich mit einem Massenmörder.
Wolfgang Bauernfeind heads the radio features department at the Haus des Rundfunks. Tonight, at his home, he's playing a recent documentary. It's about a serial killer.
Der geschätzte Kollege Dr. Petiot. Vivisektion eines Massenmörders. Feature von Martin Dillhardt.
The guests listen and discuss and critique the program. This is a social radio event. But day in, day out, radio is Bauernfeind's work, and he's usually going in and out of the Haus des Rundfunks studios.
This one is the most interesting part of the studio, is without echo, this one. So I can demonstrate it to you. Now, the sound is without any echo. Now I go from this room out, and you can listen to the change of my voice. So, I go out. Now, the voice changed, and now I'm here, outside of the studio again.
Wolfgang Bauernfeind has produced a five-part history series on the old Haus des Rundfunks. By the 1930s, Germany had more radios per capita than any other nation. Bauernfeind says the things we take for granted today, tape recording, two-channel stereo, all those things got their start here.
Broadcast in stereo in 1944 during the war. So, and the kind of recording outside. And a lot of reporters, they went with the German troops. They were really embedded. This was the first kind of embedding journalist. It was an invention of the Nazis.
Already in this building, the stereotechnik was developed. It came with the invention of the magnetophonic tape. But they recorded only music at that time, just as a kind of an experiment, because nobody in Germany had a stereo set. There was only one person with a stereo set at home. Goebbels.
Die wirkliche Durchtränkung des Volkes mit den geistigen Inhalten unserer
Goebbels, says Leo Braun, was Hitler's minister of propaganda, and Bauernfeind calls him a seducer.
He wanted to seduce German people, and he used the radio as an instrument for these tasks.
Der rundfunkpolitischen Betätigung, der wir in Zukunft gemeinsam zu dienen haben.
Goebbels asked now the people of Berliner Rundfunk, this very building here, he asked them to come in here for a big meeting. He was standing about here. They were sitting and standing around. Imagine hundreds of people, and he was addressing them. You can hear that in the archive, in a rather sweet voice, saying softly, almost seducing them, we are coming into this nation, into this building, with a new conception of Germany, with a new idea for Germany, and we want you to help us to put it into reality and to support the nationalistic idea in movement. And he is, I have the feeling, like a boa constrictor, like a giant snake, yes? He is almost dancing around them in that melody of a voice. And then suddenly he says, but if we can't win you over, we have absolutely different means to succeed. Boah! It goes down your spine listening to that. And then the directors next day in the concentration camp, etc.
The Haus des Rundfunks was built in a spirit of democracy and open to high hopes and ideals. But just 2 years later, it turned Nazi. Goebbels knew the power of this new medium, radio. It was good for broadcasting Hitler's speeches, but many other things, too. Radio, said Goebbels, should be a good companion and encourage a positive attitude to life. And so, even in war, there was happy time programming.
Wir grüßen euch und wir erfüllen euren Wunsch.
At one point, we have to be fair, he was a genius of communication, of propaganda, not a normal person. But nobody knows that he was in exact knowledge of the leading American literature, how to make advertising for commercial success, for political success. And he was so self-conceited that in 45, the end of the Second World War, he expected that the Americans would ask him to come over and to take over a big commercial imperium because of his outstanding abilities to move nations, populations, whatsoever.
Library in the broadcast house.
Perhaps we can find something in this history books.
Here are documents and books about the history of the Haus des Rundfunks in this classification group. Okay, these are photos from 1929 when this house was built.
The house was designed by Hans Poelzig, an expressionist architect and also a creator of stage sets for theater and silent film. On the outside, the house is formal, but on the inside, surprisingly colorful, with sap green banisters, giant lanterns, and staircases of Bakelite or pumpkin orange. No other broadcast house in the world has such a history. In a mere 2 decades, it was built, seized, occupied, surrounded, barricaded, vandalized, all documented here in the library.
So on this page, I see the skylights are totally shattered, many of them letting water in. Here's a picture of rubbish all over the floors. And what is this? The Haus des Rundfunks.
It's a destroyed studio.
This is a studio?
Yes.
It looks like a prison.
Yes.
Wow. Utter destruction.
In April 45, the Russians were already in town. And so the broadcasting building was ordered to be defended like a fortress. And then came the order that the building has to be blown up before the Russians arrive. Blown up! And boxes arrived here with dynamite, yes? And these people were asked to distribute it properly around the building to blow it up. And they did not do it. They did not blow up the building. And we had a sound engineer in that building called Krüger. And Krüger dashed in shortly before the Russians took over, in the very last minutes of an exploding war into the end of the war, and rescued some of his bloody stereo tapes.
The last days of the Nazi regime, before the Soviets and the Russians came, there were a lot of young girls here, secretary work and so on. And it was an atmosphere of, it was the end. And it was an atmosphere of, we want to make love now, because we don't know if we are killed or not one day later or 2 days later. So we have only one hour or two, 1 day to make love or to feel what it is. And so here was a big orgy, and all people made love here in this building before the Russians came.
And now, more than 6 decades after, no bombs this night in Berlin. After the Nazis, the Soviets occupied the city and the Haus des Rundfunks. Sometimes people disappeared into it to reemerge in Russia in a camp, or maybe not at all. The Soviets left the building stripped bare, the roof leaking, but the elevator still worked, going up and down. In the 1950s, the building at long last returned to German hands and was now the headquarters of Radio Free Berlin, Sendefreies Berlin. It was time then to rebuild the studios, renovate the Hall of Light, the Lichthof, mop up the pools of water, and repaint.
This building was not bombed because the Allies were clever enough to see we have to use the radio station after the Second World War. So the Russians didn't bomb it, and the Americans didn't bomb it, and the British didn't bomb it.
I mean, I remind you, we had a long war, we had a severe bombing, we had a Russian occupation, etc. Now we were digging, yes, stone measuring, so to speak, for our own past. Everybody fancied that this Lichthof had been a very respectful building, dignity, brownish, yes, coming in and you feel awe, you feel a bit smaller than the building. And then one day, the new bricks had been ordered already, they had been ordered already in brownish, yes, respectful tone. And one day, I show you the piece now, I show you exactly the spot now. When they opened the room under this staircase, they found here one little hole and one lazy mason hadn't cleaned in 29 when that building was constructed, and in there you could find a small piece of the original ceramic brick. One little one. The original color is fresh, is yellow, yes? Not respectful, challenging.
Challenging. Since then, the old house has continued to change and to challenge. During the Cold War, there was a kind of battle for the airwaves in Berlin between the communist East part and in the West, RIAS and other networks started by the Allies. There was also SFB, or Radio Free Berlin, which in 1957 moved back to the old Haus des Rundfunks.
Okay.
Egger sprang eben auf 4.55 Uhr.
This is very important. This is the first announcement of the first moment SFB is on air. And the announcer was a very famous man of radio history in Germany, Alfred Braun. Alfred Braun. This is the first announcement, original recorded.
Hier ist der Sender Freies Berlin mit seinem ersten Programm. Wir senden über Mittelwelle mit 566 Kilohertz, über Ultrakurzwelle mit 90,0 Megahertz und über den Drahtfunk im Langwellenbereich mit 291 Kilohertz.
This was a very famous Berlin Bell of Peace, located in the town hall of Berlin-Schöneberg. And all the very important ceremonies after the Second World War in West Berlin were announced by these bells.
Every German who bought a radio or television had to pay a special fee, and this fee paid for all kinds of programs. SFB began to pour out radio news, drama, music, children's programs, and television as well. Wolfgang Bahnfein says it was like the BBC model of public rather than commercial broadcasting.
The idea was public radio, independent of the state and independent of the business. Only responsible to the listeners and to the spectators of TV.
All well and good. But then came a surprise. The Haus des Rundfunks, that had been so nationalistic during the Second World War, now turned international. Just as it gave birth to new audio technology in the 1930s and 40s, the house now gave rise to a new kind of radio and a new kind of reporting. It started training producers and journalists from other countries to use stereo recordings and ambience and to create something called the feature. Leo Braun was a pioneer of this new form of radio storytelling, where voice gives way to sound, pure sound, a straight shot to the listener and to the imagination.
We were meeting outside in the sea, so to speak, with these feature conferences, and understood ourselves like shoemakers, craftsmen. What did you do wrong with that piece? Look at the leather you have chosen. Why do you make that cut here and not there? Teaching each other. And I would say the basic melody of it was constructive honesty. And it became a kind of a brotherhood. All my friends, without one exception, are international friends. This is my family. That international congregation of feature makers based on trust, honesty, and constructive cooperation.
From the 1930s and radio dramas by Bertolt Brecht to hundreds of concerts during the 1940s by great conductors and musicians, Furtwängler, von Karajan, Walter Gieseking, and many others, on through the decades to the 21st century, the Haus des Rundfunks, says Leo Braun, has come a long, long way.
When you listen to the big speeches, it's a ground-laying ceremony. Everything is said for good purposes. It should be for the truth. It should be even for the love, it was said. Einstein had said this, yes? It should be for bringing the nations closer to another, to each other. And it was even said that the nations suffer in a way just using newspapers and the traditional forms of information not being close enough and informed enough about other nations, other people, etc. All this was very far-minded and far-looking, said at the ground-laying ceremony. And it was only for 2 years. Then the Third Reich came in. And now you might say that after these turbulent times, we had to pass. The truth, it's now daily routine.
Peter Leonard Brown. I'm Alex Fenos.
Wir legen den Grundstein zum Haus einer großen, wahren Folter. Von hier aus werden über Jahre und Menschen mit der Klarheit ihrer Stimme, ihrer Gesinnung, ihrer Kunst, ihrer Kenntnis der ganzen Welt dienen.
You've been listening to a documentary about the Haus des Rundfunks, Berlin's historic broadcasting center. This documentary was made possible by the RBB in Berlin and the Goethe Institute in Washington, D.C. It was produced by Alex Van Oss. We also heard from journalist Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc about her groundbreaking book Random Family, and Edward Dimmenberg about film noir and the German connections to Hollywood. The Berlin Journal is a production of the American Academy in Berlin and NPR, National Public Radio. For more on the American Academy in Berlin, please visit americanacademy.de. And for more on NPR Berlin, please visit nprberlin.de. Our production team includes Ralph Martin in Berlin and Sarah Richards in Washington. I'm your host, RJ McGill. Have a wonderful new year.